The 1996 Sun Stunts Symposium presents session number 262, Departing the Faith, the Ironic Example of Apostle John Boynton, a paper by David Sean Mutillo. Please note that because this session is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes on the second side of this tape will be blank.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Stacy Ford. Excuse this fuzz. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe someone will come and fix it in a minute. My name is Stacy Ford. I'll be chairing this session. For those of you who may be confused about where you are, this is session number 262, Departing the Faith, the Ironic Example of Apostle John Boynton. Our speaker today will be David Sean Mutillo, not Mutillo. He is an MA student at Fuller Theological Seminary, which I'm told is based... Where is it based again, I'm sorry? It's based in Pasadena, but he attends a branch in Seattle. He is a single father of a son who turns 2 today, and instead of spending his birth, he's sacrificed to come spend his day with us today. He has an undergraduate degree in history with a secondary degree in politics and government, and he is studying, he would like to be a teacher of American religious history, is that correct? Okay. Albert asked him to speak because he thought that this project that he was working on with John Boynton would be of interest, which obviously is, with all of you here today. And we are pleased to have him with us. Thank you very much, Dave.
I'd like to begin by taking the opportunity to thank Albert and the Sunstone Foundation for having me here, and for all of you for actually coming out. I wasn't quite sure what to expect, and I'm glad I'm not just busy speaking to the chair. With that in mind, we can begin. At the present time, the apostasy or excommunication of a general authority is extremely rare. But this has not always been the case. In the early days of the church, apostasy and excommunication of the church's general authorities was all too common. By 1840, more than half of the original quorum of the 12 had been excommunicated at one time or another, and several members of the first presidency had also left the church, and more would depart before the end of the Nauvoo era. What was not normal, however, was for a former authority to maintain friendly and positive relations with his former peers while remaining outside of the church himself. Yet in spite of his excommunication during the collapse of Mormon Kirtland, this is exactly what Apostle John Boynton chose to do. The purpose of this paper will be to briefly examine Apostle Boynton's life and the relationship that he chose to maintain with the church long after his excommunication. John Farnham Boynton was born on September 20, 1811, in East Bradford, Massachusetts, the fourth child of Eliphalet Lett and Susan Boynton. John was a part of the seventh generation of Boyntons in this country, bearing a proud family heritage both in England, where his descendants had included lords, knights, members of parliament, and several high sheriffs, and in America, where 71 Boyntons had served in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War, including John's grandfather Samuel and all 5 of Samuel's brothers. Like many of his American forefathers, John was raised in Bradford, and there he received his education in the common schools and possibly learned one of the trades he would later practice, that of shoemaking. It was also there that he heard his first lecture on geology, given by mathematician Benjamin Greenleaf, a subject that he would pursue vigorously for the last 45 years of his life. Little is known about him until his contact with Mormon missionaries in 1832. In mid-August of 1832, missionaries Orson Hyde and Samuel Smith, the prophet's brother, arrived in Bradford and commenced preaching the message of the restored gospel on August 18th. On the 19th, Hyde and Smith held 2 more meetings in Bradford and stayed the night at the Boynton home. Throughout the rest of August and into September, Orson Hyde and Samuel Smith continued to visit with the Boyntons and even spent time discussing Alexander Campbell's treatise against the Book of Mormon delusions with the Boyntons. Sometime later that month, John appeared in Kirtland and was baptized into the church by the prophet himself and was ordained by the hand of the prophet's counselor, Sidney Rigdon. At his present, it's uncertain as to what office John was ordained to. Older sources claim that he was ordained to the position of elder, but the Kirtland Council Minute Book makes it clear that John was not ordained to the position of elder until November 16th. We can only speculate about why Boynton waited until he had visited Kirtland to be baptized instead of undergoing baptism in East Bradford. Perhaps he wished to investigate the church further, as many others before him had. When we take this into account, in conjunction with the fact that his family had apparently read Alexander Campbell's Delusions pamphlet and discussed it with the missionaries, we can fairly conclude that his conversion to Mormonism was a reasonably informed one, not the conversion of a simpleton who had been duped, nor an emotional one like many of those that occurred under the emotional duress raised by many preachers of the Second Great Awakening. Excuse the windstorm that's going on the microphone. When John began his first mission is uncertain. Those who have transcribed the early journals of Zebedee Coltrane presume that it is John Boynton that accompanied Coltrane on a preaching tour that began in Ohio on the 27th of September. If this assumption is correct, Brother Boynton preached his first message as a Latter-day Saint in Madison on September 30, exhorting those in attendance to contend for the faith that was once given to the saints according to Jude. If we accept this interpretation of the John references in Coltrane's diaries, Boynton would have continued preaching with Coltrane and other missionaries, including Daniel Copley and David W. Patton in northern Ohio, until mid-November. However, an examination of Patton's journals and other sources demonstrates that all of these John references actually refer to John Murdoch and not to John Boynton. On November 16, the prophet Joseph Smith finally ordained Boynton an elder during an elders' conference at Kirtland. On the 19th of November, John Boynton departed on his first mission with Zebedee Coltrane to northeast Ohio and northwest Pennsylvania. This mission would last through the 5th of January in 1833. At various times, they were in company with Reynolds and William Cahoon, William and Hiram Smith, and David Patton, among others. During this time, they preached numerous sermons, raised up branches of the church, at least one of which can be attributed to them with certainty, the one at Elk Creek, Pennsylvania, and baptized at least 23 into the church. After returning to Kirtland on the 5th of January, Boynton attended an elders' conference on the 13th, where he was appointed to another mission, this time with Evan M. Green. Quick returns to the mission field were not uncommon at this time, and after having been back in Kirtland for only 10 days, he returned to the mission field with his new companion on January 15th. After preaching in several towns in northern Ohio and Pennsylvania, on January 20th, Elder Boynton performed his first recorded baptism, baptizing Rhoda Winiger after the Sunday morning meeting in Springfield, Pennsylvania. By the time they returned to Kirtland on the 30th of March for a brief rest, they had held almost 50 meetings, encountered their fair share of opposition, participated in at least 33 recorded baptisms, including those of Benjamin Winchester and Jedediah M. Grant, and they had organized the branch at Elk Creek, which had previously been raised up by John Boynton and Zebedee Coltrane. In fact, according to a letter most likely written while Boynton and Green were in Kirtland before returning to their mission, they believed that they had baptized somewhere between 70 or 80 members into the church in a 12-week period. On April 16, Boynton and Green returned to their missionary labors accompanied by William Saggers. By the 28th of April, Boynton and Green had parted company in Pennsylvania, and nothing is presently known regarding Boynton's activities until Green and Boynton are reunited on the 24th of June, possibly in eastern Pennsylvania, or more likely in western New York. Here, on the 25th, they organized another branch of the church with Elder Boynton presiding, and they began their journey together as commanded in a letter brought by Boynton to the home of John Boynton's father, Eliphalet, in East Bradford, Massachusetts. Traveling east, it took them 18 days to reach Bradford. On the day following their arrival, they began holding meetings, sharing the message of the restored gospel with John's old friends. 8 days later, it was decided that Green would continue to labor in the Bradford area, while Boynton should go east with Henry Harriman. Ironically, 46 years later, after his apostasy, John Boynton would take Harriman's niece, Carolyn, as his third wife. A month later, Harriman would return to Bradford to summon Green to the great work that Boynton was carrying on in southern Maine. Boynton and Green would continue ministering in Maine until mid-October, where after Green's arrival, they had baptized at least 15 new believers, including Susan Lowell, who had become Boynton's first wife in 1836. Boynton returned to Maine without Green, and apparently without a companion in November, and by the 20th, had baptized about 40 people. In June of 1834, he He was called from the work in Maine to a mission to raise funds for the Kirtland Temple with Jared Carter. The mission lasted more than 2.5 months. By early November, Boynton was back in Kirtland. In mid-November, Boynton would serve a brief one-week mission to Painesville with William McClellan. After more than 2 years of almost ceaseless missionary work, Boynton appears to have returned to Kirtland for a much-needed rest, one that would last until he returned to the mission field as one of the 12 apostles, a special witness of the gospel. In approximately 1835, John Boynton began practicing a second trade, that of dentistry. He also received his calling as one of the Quorum of the Twelve. On the 15th of February, John was ordained as an apostle under the hands of Oliver Cowdery. The apostolic blessing he received that day by the laying on of hands promised that he would declare the gospel to many nations, lead the elect triumphantly to places of refuge, stand in the day of calamity, overcome all the evils that are in the world, and see the face of his Redeemer in the flesh. His first mission as an apostle was a second week-long venture with fellow apostle William E. McClellan, this time to Huntsburg, Ohio. 2.5 weeks later, after his return to Kirtland, Boynton departed with the rest of the 12 on their previously appointed mission to the East. Documentation regarding this mission is occasional and haphazard, since many of the 12, including Boynton, did not keep diaries or journals on this mission. From the few journals and notes that we have of others, we know that Boynton ministered in New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, and possibly Ontario, Canada as well during this 4.5-month mission. Nothing is mentioned regarding him performing baptisms, and we have only a handful of notes regarding the content of his preaching. He returned from this mission to Kirtland with his colleagues, arriving in Kirtland 6th of September. This would be his last mission for the church. While Boynton continued as an active member and performing his apostolic functions in Kirtland, it seems he spent most of his time in 1836 involved in taking care of his family and starting his business with brother-in-law Jonathan Hale and fellow apostle Lyman E. Johnson. On January 20th of 1836, he married one of his converts, Susan Lowell. In late June, he began making substantial land purchases, and by mid-July, his family had arrived in Kirtland, having moved there from Bradford. 1837 brought Boynton his first child, John Lowell Boynton, born on the 7th anniversary of the founding of the church. The year also brought economic hardship to the saints and Kirtland and to John Boynton and his family. During 1836, the number of Mormon merchants in Kirtland had increased substantially, leaving them to compete with one another for business. With a lack of employment, the influx of poor saints gathering to Kirtland, land speculation, and extensive use of credit buying by the saints, by the end of 1836, the Mormon economy in Kirtland was in urgent need of help. The savior was to be a bank owned by the saints, the Kirtland Safety Society Bank Company. For reasons too numerous to explore here, the Kirtland Safety Society failed, and with it the Mormon economy in Kirtland. Many saints had placed their hopes in the success of the society, and its failure and the economic collapse that accompanied it led to a collapse in their faith. Among those whose faith collapsed under economic pressure was Apostle John Boynton. By late June, Boynton had proclaimed Joseph Smith a fallen prophet. And during that summer, he joined with other dissenters, threatening violence against church members and also in an attempt to depose Joseph Smith and to reorganize the church. On September 3rd, John Boynton was rejected from his apostleship and cut off. Although Boynton's objection that Joseph Smith had claimed that the bank was instituted by the will of God and that it would never fall is demonstrably valid, in spite of the prophet's objections, equally valid was the church's decision to cut Boynton off. On September 10, Boynton confessed his error and was restored to fellowship, but by late October, Boynton had been disfellowshipped, this time for dancing. Boynton would never return to the church after this, and he either continued or resumed his activity with the parish party and was finally excommunicated in absentia in December of 1837. Before we discuss the details of John's interaction with the church and the saints after his excommunication, we'll briefly turn aside to glance at a sketch of the rest of his life. After he departed Kirtland, John Boynton entered Columbia School, now known as Columbia University in New York City. By 1843, he had graduated from St. Louis Medical College, and he briefly practiced medicine in the East, as well as in the Old West. At the same time, John began his career as a lecturer. During 1845 and 1846, he was involved in conducting a mineralogical survey around the northern and southern shores of Lake Superior. After moving to Syracuse in about 1848, he purchased an interest in a saltworks company and continued with another project, lecturing for Samuel Morse to introduce the telegraph. In 1849, he set sail for California, involved in a number of government projects. He went to California as a bearer of dispatches to Commodore Jones, commander of the Pacific Squadron at Monterey. While in California, he was also commissioned to work in company with Weller's commission to run the boundary line between the United States and Mexico and to raise a sunken government ship, the Tonquin, from San Francisco's harbor. During his year and a half stay in California, he also formed a lasting friendship with Kit Carson and tried his hand as a 49er. During the 1850s, he lectured on natural history and the Bible throughout the country. During the 1860s, he opened chemical works both in Syracuse and Utica, New York, continued to lecture throughout the country, was involved in planning the destruction of the Confederate ship, the Albemarle, and he invented the torpedo used to destroy it. He produced his most profitable invention, the gaslight multiplier, exposed the Cardiff Giant hoax, and married his second wife in a balloon over New York City. From 1870 until his death on October 20, 1890, he continued to work as an inventor. He also continued lecturing, delivering his last lecture in 1887. He avidly pursued the recovery of his genealogy, tracing his family roots back to at least 1014 A.D., and he issued three books on Boynton genealogy. After turning 70, he began serving as president of New York City's Father Columbia newspaper and exposed the Tewsbury Almshouse horror, where it was discovered that human flesh was being tanned and turned into hide. By the time he died, he had patented more than 30 inventions, issued five different books, with one additional book being published posthumously. John Boynton was truly a man of substantial talent. Returning back to Boynton's interaction with the saints, in spite of his excommunication, he remained sympathetic to the church and friendly toward the saints throughout the rest of his life. Although his disposition went through several stages of development, reconciliation with individual members, reconciliation with Joseph Smith, and finally sympathetic and possibly positive view of the church. His pattern of behavior for his later life began to be established during the difficult times in Kirtland during the winter of 1837 and 1838. The disposition he showed toward violence during the Kirtland Temple conflicts during the summer and fall of 1837 were replaced by a new attitude as he moved into 1838. The first demonstration of this newfound disposition came in January. After the prophet had fled Kirtland, his father, Joseph Smith Sr., was arrested on a writ sworn out by John C. White, who apparently hoped that the elder Smith could be prosecuted for solemnizing marriages. Under the direction of constable and fellow excommunicant apostle Luke Johnson, Boynton positioned himself outside a window of the room where Joseph Smith Sr. was being held. Constable Johnson, having arrested Father Smith, put him in a room next to the magistrate's office, accompanied by his son, Hiram, to wait until the court was ready to hear his case. After removing the nail from the window sash, Johnson locked the door and returned to the courtroom to tell stories to cover the noise of their escape. Hiram was the first out the window, and then Hiram and Boynton helped Joseph Smith Sr. out of the window so he could make his escape. Though his disposition toward individual members of the church had changed, his attitude toward the church and her prophet had not, and those attitudes would not change for some time to come. With his late December excommunication still freshly in mind, John Boynton, along with Luke Johnson and a number of others, endorsed a letter written by Warren Parrish in February and published in the Painesville Republican attacking Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon, claiming, among other things, that they lie by revelation, swindle by revelation, and cheat and defraud by revelation. This letter was also published in at least one other paper in its entirety on March 24th of the same year, and was still being republished to attack the church and her first prophet 50 years later. The contents of this letter appear to have caused at least one missionary some consternation for a number of years. Wilford Woodruff records on at least two separate occasions, that almost 2 years apart, that this letter was being used to attack the church away as far away as the Fox Islands off the coast of Maine. A month and a half later, in March of 1838, Boynton made his break complete by publicly renouncing the Book of Mormon in the Kirtland Temple. The next recorded contact between John Boynton and the church is not for another 2 years, and by then we see a second step in Boynton's personal healing, reconciliation with the prophet. In December of 1840, Valette Kimball, in a letter to her husband, recorded the appearance of John Boynton in Nauvoo with Joseph Smith. In a rather moving passage, she mentions, "I mentioned that our people had bought a boat. The last trip she made upriver, President Smith went with her. And who should accompany him but John F. Boynton and his wife and Lyman Johnson? They made their home to Joseph Smith's all the time they were here. I never saw Joseph appear more happy. He said, 'I am going to have all my old friends around me again.' They both bought lots and calculated to build and move here the ensuing season. They called all brother and sister and appeared as friendly as I ever saw them." John again would reappear in Nauvoo in 1842, and this time he would help Joseph Jr. escape from legal entanglements. The Missourians again were attempting to bring Joseph back to Missouri in order to try him in regards to an assassination attempt on former Missouri Governor Lilburn Boggs. On September 3rd, around noon, Sheriff Pittman, accompanied by two other men, appeared at the prophet's residence planning to arrest him. Joseph was in another part of the house eating, and Boynton was the first person the officers found. They asked Boynton where Joseph was, and he responded that he'd only seen him early in the morning. But he did not say that he had seen him since. This conversation gave Joseph Smith time to make his escape out the back door to Newell K. Whitney's. These actions may have been the catalyst for a prophecy Joseph made at Nauvoo regarding John Boynton. He said to John Boynton's sister, prophesying that John would return to the church. The Boynton never would return. He would continue to maintain positive relations with the saints. Boynton again came into contact with one of the saints, Wilford Woodruff, in 1849, just prior to his departure for California. Woodruff records during this meeting with John calling him Brother Boynton, and the meeting as being pleasant. But the fact that he had yet to make his peace with the church was made clear sometime after his return from California in late September of 1850, when his only known post-Kirtland public comment regarding Mormonism was reported in a letter to schismatic leader James Strang, stating that Boynton said that Mormonism is all a humbug from first to last. Boynton's next recorded contact with the saints did not apparently come until 1872, 20 years later. By this time, his healing process appears to be complete. In November of 1871, his relative, Alma Hale, returned to Syracuse, and later that month, they departed by train for Salt Lake City, where they arrived, ironically, on April 6th. Unfortunately, Alma's diary stops at this point, but another writing of his, as well as other sources, tell us that Boynton called on President Brigham Young twice while he was being held under house arrest, and that Boynton denounced in strongest terms the persecution then being carried on against the saints. Boynton also visited with members of the Quorum of the Twelve, including his former missionary companion Orson Pratt and Lorenzo Snow, and with Erastus Snow, whom Boynton had ordained a teacher more than 50 years previous. Alma Hale recalls that they all called John brother, and that his conversation with Erastus Snow, Boynton told him to stick to the same gospel that he had been preaching for those 50 years, for it is good. Although Boynton would maintain contact with Alma well into the 1880s, his visit to Utah would be the last substantive contact that he would have with the saints during his lifetime. His final recorded comment regarding the situation of the church came in an 1886 letter to Alma, where he expressed surprise at how many saints had been imprisoned and that some of it looks like persecution, but time must work out the result. Though this last comment is assuredly anticlimactic, it is symbolic of Boynton's attitude toward the church, at peace with it, but unreconciled to it. John Boynton died outside of the church, and perhaps outside of any church. After Boynton's death, Alma Hale commented that he did not join any other denomination after departing from the saints and did not believe in any religion whatever, but that Boynton believed that if anything was right, Mormonism is. This claim by Hale may be correct, but it receives little or no support from Boynton's life or the later comments of John's third wife, Carolyn. John, during the time that he was a lecturer, endeavored to help promote standard Protestant moral values such as temperance and a need for a revival in morals. He also endorsed the Bible as a guide to follow, containing the sum total of all goodness and wisdom. Furthermore, upon numerous occasions, he gave lectures to help benefit various Protestant groups, such as the Friends Mission School or the Sunday School Missions of the First Baptist Church. However, John Boynton is never found publicly supporting the church or the Book of Mormon. Contrary to Hale's claims, Boynton's religious worldview appears to be closer to that of Protestantism than that of the saints. Though it is presently uncertain as to whether John ever was a member of any church group after departing from his faith in the restored gospel, and it is clear that he was sympathetic toward the church and perhaps held a positive view of it, it does not appear that in his later life that he held to such highly positive convictions regarding the church as Alma Hale and other Latter-day Saint writers who cite Hale would lead us to believe. John Boynton spent 5 years of his life as an active Latter-day Saint, serving as a very successful missionary and an original member of the Quorum of the Twelve. During these years, he built relationships that would be valued for many years to come. Though the problems of Kirtland proved devastating to his faith in the church, they did not destroy his friendships. He proved gracious to the saints, actively sought out reconciliation with Joseph Smith, and made his peace with the church. Unlike former apostles, Lyman E. Johnson, William McClellan, and William Smith, Boynton showed no enduring bitterness or animosity toward his former church or his former brethren. Rather, there was a lasting bond of brotherhood between Brother John and the leaders of the saints.
We're left with a great deal of time. If anyone would like to ask David some questions, you're welcome to.
No, he never made any claim of the sort in any of his extant writings, and we have about 6 of his books that are around, including some with biographical information.
Where did most of the information that you presented, where did it come from?
Everywhere from Syracuse, New York, to San Francisco, California. So there's no bulk of things. It's been a huge undertaking. There's been nothing substantive ever done on John Boynton, and I'm currently working on a book-length treatment of his life. It's more like you have one of those big 1,000-piece puzzle boxes. Somebody took it and threw it all over the house. And that's how it is, hunting and pecking up little items of information. You sit in newspaper libraries and just go over newspapers where you know he was in town for a certain time, hoping for a reference to him. So there's no one certain spot. It's just all over. Ron.
His wife, did they die or did they divorce?
His first wife died after childbirth in 1859. He separated from his second wife not long after they were married, and they divorced in Maine in 1881. And then his third wife, of course, survived him. Yes.
The fellow Apostle Orson Pratt said that almost all of the leaders who left the church and went to New York went into spiritualism.
Okay, we have no real clear indication of Boynton's views. I haven't been able to document yet whether he was a member of any church, although I have found the name of the minister who performed his funeral. So I'm going to follow that up and see what connections it leads to. All of his interaction as far as religious things seem to be very much in the Protestant vein. He would lecture different Protestant churches, do different benefits for them, and nothing really that really ties into an aspect of spiritualism that I've seen to this point, but that'll await further clarification.
Okay. Thank you. You have one who excommunicated in September and December of 37. In March, he announced the Book of Mormon. 7th of April, in the minutes of the Quorum of the Twelve at the General Conference, it talks about an report on the 12 apostles by David Patton. And he says, I cannot recommend the following, and Boynton is one who
right.
Recommended. Would that indicate that maybe he was excommunicated a third time?
No, it wouldn't be. His departure was very final in December. In fact, he was excommunicated in absentia. He didn't even bother to attend to the things the church asked him to. What I think it's real clearly indicative is the chaos in Kirtland, and that the news of those excommunications, which were carried out there in late December, had actually failed to reach Missouri.
He would say he can't recommend him as an apostle rather than say he's no longer...
because I don't think Patton actually knew that the excommunication had been carried out yet.
That's
3 or 4 months later. That is what I believe at this current point. And there's nothing from the Missouri documents indicating knowledge of any of the apostles' excommunications which were carried out in Kirtland in December. They show no knowledge of them at all for any of the others who were excommunicated at that time as well. You've got to remember that there was a certain amount of chaos going on in Missouri as well with the problems with Whitmer and Lyman E. Johnson. It wasn't all peace and happiness there. There was a lot of chaos in the church at the time.
I wondered if there was any evidence what his relationship was with the other apostles who were excommunicated.
Well, there are a number of things that we can talk with. The first of those is with Lyman Johnson. And he appears with him. It's Lyman Johnson, John Boynton, and Joseph Smith that come riding up on the boat into Nauvoo in 1840. And they were former business partners. So there was certainly some interaction there. I've found no interaction with William Smith, with William McClellan, none with Luke Johnson, although there was that brief after 1838, you had that brief interaction between Luke Johnson, John Boynton, helping Father Smith escape, and then with the parish letter in 1838. But it appears after 1838, Luke Johnson and John permanently parted company. So the only two he seems to have interacted with after 38, after his excommunication, would have been those two individuals.
Neither of those didn't sound like it was a uniting because of religious or ideological conditions.
Right. Well, they really, after Boynton had denounced the Book of Mormon, they had nothing that was going to hold them for them to interact. The only reason for even Lyman and John to interact later on was the fact that they'd been sued heavily in 1838 and were indebted thousands and thousands of dollars. The question is, in what terms did he now denounce the Book of Mormon? It was within the context of the splinter group, the parish group, in the Kirtland Temple. Stephen Burnett was giving his reasons for why he had rejected the Book of Mormon. And it was in this set of circumstances that John Boynton and a number of others concurred with and supported his remarks. That Burnett gave, he doesn't actually list them in his letter, as I remember. So they aren't a clearly laid out item, but I can look into that and provide you with some information if you want that later on. Yes, sir.
There was a follow-up in the entire problem that occurred in the temple where they actually did debate the pro and con of the validity of the Book of Mormon sometime shortly before April 15th.
No, I think it was going to be after 15th because the Stephen Burnett letter is specifically dated April 15th, 1838, and he records in there the planned upcoming debate that was going to go on.
I recall he says that the debate had taken place, but he had not heard the outcome.
That's possible. I'd have to go back and look at the letter, but there's nothing said mentioning Boynton or him being involved with that I've seen as of this point.
Parrish took up the negative argument and the positive was presented by
possibly either Martin Harris or Joseph Coe.
Burnett is simply saying, I don't know what happened as the result.
Right. Right. And all I'm saying is I have no information as to whether Boynton was even involved with that or not, because for my work on Boynton, that debate is irrelevant if he wasn't there. Ron.
Do you see Boynton as kind of a role model for just in the Mormon? His response is kind of unusual and very kind of a player.
I do see him in that vein because of what he chose to do. When you have problems, whether it be with a church or with individuals, you have options. Some people choose to nurse their bitterness because it makes them feel good. Other people choose to do something about it. You can either languish in that and let it eat you and fellowship with that, or you can reconcile those differences and make something meaningful out of those relations. There's a church that I left, and I still pursue meaningful relationships with the people, but I'd never attend the church again. And I see Boynton as an example that you know, you've got to do something about it. You're going to make a decision by what you do or don't do. That's going to be your choice. Boynton decided to actively involve himself with the saints. He decided to put those incidents behind him. He decided to actively go out to Illinois. He spent the time resolving that conflict with Joseph Smith. He even journeyed all the way out to Utah and met with his brethren out there, even though he had no belief in the church. So I see him as an example because he provides us an example of active reconciliation, not just passive and just hoping things will go away, but he actively pursued a reconciliation with those who are around him. Yes, sir.
It's a little jarring, you know, just fellowshipping for that century. What were the circumstances? Wasn't that unusual?
It was unusual for the time, but you have to remember that the early morality and mindset of the church was not what it became in later years. That was one of the things that was frowned upon within standard Protestant denominations, was dancing, and so was it with the church at that time. He was holding a ball in his store where members of what they called the world were present as well, and so they disfellowshipped him for it, and he refused to repent and say, well, I'm sorry, I won't do it again. So what you have is an example of the changing moral views of the church, just as the rest of society has changed their view, although there are still a few denominations that hold dancing is evil and from the devil and saints shouldn't practice it. They don't list a particular... He held a ball at his store, and him and all those who had been at the ball were subjected to discipline. I believe there are 22 people disciplined, according to the Kirtland Council Minute Book, for participating in that dance. Yes, sir.
Are you familiar with the book, The Fate of the Prosecute, from First Speakers of Joseph Smith?
Marginally, yes, from occasional quotes from Rick Grunder, who constantly includes this on his notes on John Boynton, how Boynton wasn't like this. I chose not to cite that simply because Boynton really never was a serious persecutor of Joseph Smith. His violence during the Kirtland Temple period was while Joseph wasn't there. And the only other episode that we have is an attempt to sue Joseph Smith, in which apparently he won a judgment. Whether he ever got any money out of it is highly questionable. But he didn't really pursue any persecution of Joseph. He was, you know, adamantly angry about some of his behavior, as the letter in the Painesville Republican demonstrates, but he never engaged in outright persecution. That's why I chose to leave that as a separate issue and didn't think it really fit Boynton's life and interaction. Are there any further questions? Yes, sir.
Later on in St. George, while we were taking pleasure of man, I recorded a dancing instrument where the church is frowning on round dancing, but square dancing was okay. And so, just out of curiosity, do you know whether Boynton had a round dance or a square dance?
The Kirtland Council Minute Book doesn't indicate what kind of dance. It simply calls it a ball, that he held a ball, a dancing ball. I'm not certain that even square dancing was really highly acceptable in the church during the Kirtland era. I think that may have awaited later developments.
My friend talks about the place over Santa Clara. My father was there, and because of it, this incident happened. You know, Mr. Pinky knew who it was, and they warned not to do it. He had a church social, and the music started, and he did it anyhow. So he was really castigated on the community. And he never participated in the church after that. He moved to Salt Lake. Anthony W. Ivins came up and made a personal appeal to him to come back in, but he was so angry about that that he never came back in.
It's interesting.
Those of whom I was instituted the disfellowshipping in my whole life, too.
At this point in time, I don't remember who it was. It'd be fairly easy to look up in the Kirtland Council Minute Book, but I'm not certain of who it was.
I just wonder what level the middle management
was. Well, it wasn't one of the apostles, and it certainly wasn't one of the first presidency. It was somebody who quite possibly had less authority than Boynton himself, although the 12 didn't really hold a great degree of authority at that time. It wasn't until later that their actual authority developed. Yes, sir.
Even though always friendly with the Mormons. What was his testimony, so to speak, of the church after that? Did he pretty much reject most of the doctrine, or did he, is there any way he indicated he held on to any beliefs at all?
That's what I will explore in my book, and there wasn't time for it in this particular paper. But there were many beliefs of the church that he also held to. Now, whether it was because of attachment with the church or because there were things that were commonly accepted in society is something that's still regarded looking into. A good example for that is the church's teaching on creation. It's taught that creation was the forming of organized matter. And Boynton concurs with this. And what I intend to do is go through his different speeches, and I have parts of text of his lectures, and see what he indicates and explore his thought and compare it with the church's thought and doctrine. But he clearly held to some of the doctrine still, whether it was because of something he held previously, something that was socially acceptable, or something of the church's is really open to question. And I think that'll be hard for me to prove one way or the other. Well, he certainly didn't practice it, but as I indicated in the paper, he was very sympathetic, at least toward the church being persecuted for it. He denounced the persecution when he visited Brigham Young. He was shocked by the number of people that in the 1880s were being imprisoned for it. And he said that it looked like persecution, but that the time would tell whether it was or not. So he didn't hold it, but he seemed to be content to let the saints practice their doctrine without imposing his views upon them.
In his role, did he continue to stay in the church, or was he too flamboyant, too whatever to stay in?
I don't think he was too flamboyant to stay in. We know this, that based on all the other excommunications, if he had stayed in the church, he would have been the third LDS prophet. John Taylor would have never led the church. And if you read through what he accomplished and the things he did, I think he would have been a very dynamic leader and a good follower for Brigham Young. But unfortunately, we'll never know what the result of that would have been. But that's where he would have ended up as the third prophet. Any further questions?
We'd like to thank David for coming to our session today, and I'd like to encourage you to attend the other sessions going on today and tomorrow, and enjoy the rest of the symposium. Thank you.